You can meet and hear Bill Barr, Albert Mohler, Chris Rosebro, Brian Wolfmiller, Joel Bierman, and Will Whedon at the 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 24th and Saturday, June 25th in Chicago. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 24th and 25th at Concordia University, Chicago. Some pro-choice arguments are pretty flimsy, like the fetus is not alive. That's pretty easy to disprove. Just open an embryology book or ask a doctor. Others, like, well, yes, it's alive, but so is an acorn, so is a tomato, so is a jellyfish, and we don't worry about what we do to them. Those are more difficult to answer, but they're not unanswerable. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us for some pro-life responses to common pro-choice arguments, Dr. Stephen Christie. He's a physician and an attorney and author of the new book, Speaking for the Unborn, 30-Second Pro-Life Rebuttals to Pro-Choice Arguments. Dr. Christie, welcome.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Why are you pro-life?
Well, I say everybody that's pro-life needs to have a good 30-second summary of why they're pro-life, and this is mine. I say I'm pro-life because I'm pro-science, because there's overwhelming scientific consensus that life begins at conception, and I'm pro-life because social justice begins in the womb, because every living human being is entitled to the most fundamental human right, that being life itself, because being a burden on someone is never justification for killing them. I'm pro-life because I'm pro-woman. Abortion degrades women, treating their fertility as a defect and enabling men to use and abandon women at their most vulnerable. Abortion never empowers women, only the men who wish to exploit them. And I'm pro-life because I'm against violence. Abortion is not only immoral, but it's an act of extreme violence against the most vulnerable. I'm pro-life because of the visible evidence, because ultrasound and MRI clearly show the world what's moving inside a woman's body, and that's a living baby. And lastly, I'm pro-life because of objective morality. If abortion is the killing of an unborn child, then it's immoral and cowardly to remain silent, and that's why I'm pro-life. After I say it, I say, and why aren't you?
Why is it important to thoroughly understand how abortion supporters think about abortion?
Well, I've learned that if your goal is to stop abortion, your goal, what you have to focus on is on winning hearts. And to win hearts requires you interacting with people one at a time in a caring way. So you need to be educated. Knowing simply that abortion is wrong, well, that's a great start, but it's not enough to sustain a movement. We have to be able to articulate are very specific reasons why abortion is wrong. And we have very compelling evidence and reasons based on science, the law, morality, and social justice concerns. Our cause is a winning one. We rely on facts, truth, and science. The pro-choice position, sadly, and I don't mean to disparage anybody, but it relies on cliches and rhetorical deception and personal attacks. And there's 62 million voices, 62 million abortions since Roe that are asking us to speak on their behalf.
You say that pro-abortion arguments really boil down to a single falsehood, quote, sex is liberating and should be without consequences. Explain that, if you would.
Well, the way I sort of explain it is, if you go back 50 years ago to the sexual revolution, you know, the goals of the sexual revolution was to unmoor sex from marriage and family. You know, we were told that sex outside of marriage was liberating and it was empowering, it was wonderful, and it was completely without consequences. Shockingly, it turns out there were some rather serious consequences, not the least of which was a surge in unwanted pregnancies outside the safety net of marriage and family. And so that left these sexual revolutionaries two choices. One, right, they could admit this experiment backfired and they could return to traditional mores, or they could just, well, you know, get rid of those darn pregnancies. And we know exactly which choice they picked, because sex and sexual identity and sexual self-expression and now whatever sexual fluidity is, I'm not sure what that is, these are the hallmarks of today's secular culture. And the only way to get rid of those darn pregnancies is to pretend they don't exist, to deny the truth of their being. And I think of those three monkeys, the see no evil, hear no evil, and speak no evil. So they have to be like these monkeys. To maintain this falsehood, they have to be blind to the truth, and they have to be deaf to the truth, and they have to never, ever, ever speak the truth. And if you maintain this denial generation or two, we lose sight of the truth entirely. And that's where we have been this last generation, in a culture of death where we're deaf, blind, and we dare not speak the truth about abortion.
Why should pro-lifers generally avoid religious arguments against abortion when engaging with abortion supporters?
Now, it's a great question, and this is a controversial point that I have in the book, but I feel very strongly about it. So the vast majority of abortion advocates are secular liberals who think that the religious are unsophisticated and we're brainwashed and we're unthinking and we're backwards and we're probably intolerant Jesus freaks. So if you're debating a non-religious person and you've made 8 wonderful non-religious arguments explaining why abortion is wrong, but then you happen to throw in the word God or sanctity of life or sin or mention the Bible, you'll see the face of the person you're speaking with dramatically change. And you can read their mind immediately. And it says something like this. You know, somebody will turn to me because I made a mistake of mentioning the Bible or sin. And you'll hear this is what they're saying in their brain. They're saying, I'm so sorry, Steve. I didn't realize you're a freak. Have a nice day. And at that point, every non-religious argument I made, and those were compelling arguments, they just vanished. They're thrown out the window. So I've come to learn that making a religious argument is handing your opponent a huge club with which to beat you over the head. You know, we have so many tremendous non-religious arguments that powerfully explain why abortion is wrong. We need to stick to them. That's my opinion. And that doesn't mean we don't bring our faith into this movement, which is incredibly important. But we don't do it, this is my opinion, we don't bring it directly to the person we're speaking with if they're not a religious person. Certainly if they're a religious person, faith-based arguments can be very strong. And certainly before you go out there, you know, I tend to, like lots of people, we tend to rush out into the world and start interacting. And, you know, a priest friend of mine who has had a great influence over the years, he says, you know, don't rush out. The first thing you do is you stop and you pray. Then the next thing you do is you make a personal sacrifice, you know, on behalf of the cause or the person you're going to talk about, you know. And then once you've prayed, you've made this sacrifice, you know, as we say in our traditional Catholic faith is, you know, we offer it up, you know, for the cause, for the person we're about to speak with. Then you rush out to that person. So even if you're going to stick to secular language because you're speaking with secular people, it doesn't mean you don't bring your faith into it. You just don't put it in their face. But it doesn't help. You're not going to win hearts that way. That's been my experience.
What basic definitions do we need?
There are a bunch of them that we need to know. There's a lot of terms that are thrown out. So we'll hear, you know, discussions about what is alive and what's not alive. That's for me, that's probably the first thing you need to know. And that is whether something is alive or living is not a matter of philosophy or religion or politics. It's a scientific question that science has fully answered. And it's spelled out in every embryology and every biology textbook used in every medical school across the world. And there's overwhelming scientific consensus that from the moment of conception, an embryo fulfills what we call the criteria of biological life, which are 7, 8, or 8 criteria. So when people are talking about clumps of cells or products of conception, by definition, we're talking about living human beings. That's really probably the most important definition that we should be aware of. You know, the other things that we should have, you know, when we describe what is abortion, you should know, have your definition ready. You know, for me, it's the intentional killing of an unborn child. And that's something you should be able to say. And the word child, by Merriam-Webster's definition, is a recently born or unborn person. And there's other definitions. They're all in the book. You know, personhood is another one that's important. Body part. People will tell you that, you know, it's just a pregnant woman just has, it's just part of her body, an embryo or a fetus, like the appendix is or the tonsil. And so you should know, for instance, the body part is defined as a definition. You know, it's a part of the body that shares the same genetic code as the rest of the body, and it doesn't direct its own development. And a fetus and embryo don't share the same genetic code. In fact, half the time they don't have the same sex, and they direct their own development. So there's a lot of definitions like that are important, and they're all in the book that we talked about, which is Speaking for the Unborn, 30-Second Pro-Life Rebuttals to Pro-Choice Arguments. And the book is, you know, it's a fairly unique thing. The book really has collected all the best arguments that I've heard over the years from the pro-life side. I've compiled them, I've edited them, I put them together, and I've presented them in a user-friendly way that people can really bring into practical situations, debates, and discussions. I think that's a fairly unique thing, and I think it's a really powerful book. Along with the book is a website, speakingfortheunborn.org, that has fantastic resources. It's got a 4-part teaching video series on the subject of everything you need to know. Abortion, if you've been in these debates, we talk about the science and embryology and important constitutional law cases. We talk about abortion procedures and Planned Parenthood and strategies for participating in the pro-life movement. So there's a lot of resources that are out there. And both in the book and the website, we have photos of the unborn in various stages of embryos and fetuses and videos. So when somebody says to you, you know, a 12-week baby is just a clump of cells, you can pull up your phone and say, hey, you know, can I show you a photo of a 12-week-old baby? And do you really think that's a clump of cells? And do you really feel comfortable, you know, tearing off its limbs? And often these photos and these videos, you know, I let the babies speak for themselves, and they move hearts away sometimes just words and arguments in the room.
Let's deal with a few of those arguments and get your rebuttal to them, beginning with that basic one that the fetus or the embryo is not alive.
Yeah, here again, as we mentioned, that we reiterate that it's not an issue of philosophy or religion or politics, that it's a scientific question, that science is fully settled. And then I like to point out to a survey that was done in the last year and a half, which is the largest one ever conducted. It's over 5,000 biologists at over 1,000 worldwide institutions, and they were asked whether life begins at conception. And a full 96% agreed that life begins at conception. And the pro-choice movement was upset with this. They said it must be a biased study, and they're right. But it was biased against the pro-life movement because all of these biologists, they self-describe themselves, and they were 89% liberal, 85% pro-choice, and 63% non-religious. So I say let's stick to the most basic scientific fact in this debate, that life begins at conception.
How about the argument that goes, granted, the fetus is alive, but an acorn is alive, a tomato is alive, a jellyfish is alive. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, you know, an acorn and a jellyfish, those are things. And yes, they're alive. A jellyfish is alive, but a jellyfish is a thing. A human being is a person, and a human being has intrinsic value that things don't have. So most people won't think that it's immoral to kill a three-year-old cow for food. But I don't think anybody would agree that you can kill a three-year-old child for any reason, because one is a thing and one is a person.
The pro-choice argument also goes that the unborn are not yet human beings.
Yeah, personhood and human beings is not one of degrees. They are stages of development. So just as an adolescent becomes an adult, an embryo becomes a fetus, which becomes a newborn. These are stages of development. They're not stages of intrinsic value. An adult does not have greater intrinsic value than an adolescent, than does a newborn.
You had mentioned the definition of body parts before. I have heard a pro-choice argument that the fetus is part of the woman's body, therefore she can do with it as she please.
Yeah, you know, that comes down to this autonomy argument all the time. And the classic one is my body, my choice. And the way I always respond to those things is I address each one, the my body and the my choice. So with respect to my body, I tend to agree with women. I say, you know, I fully support the right of a woman to do whatever she wants to her own body. I just don't believe she has the right to do what she wants to someone else's body. And a pregnancy always involves at least two bodies, sometimes more. And in my choice, I said, yes, a woman should have the right to choose. I completely agree. The choice she has, though, is not whether or not to kill her baby. It's whether or not to have sex in the first place. And when a woman decides to have sex, she does so with the full knowledge that there's a possibility that the act is going to create a new living being inside her. And then it's reasonable then for society to expect that woman who knowingly consented to that risk to live with inconvenience, even really significant inconvenience, if the only alternative is killing a child. So I say I'm also very pro-choice, just with one less choice than you. I believe you can choose abstinence or motherhood or adoption. I just don't believe you can choose to kill your baby. And, you know, there's an old expression that's right on point here. We say the right to swing your fist ends just before it touches my nose.
Dr. Stephen Christie is our guest, author of the new book, Speaking for the Unborn. We're getting pro-life responses to pro-choice arguments. The argument on the other side of the break, the fetus does not have rights until it's viable or reaches a certain level of development or maybe even leaves the womb.
You can call it what you like. I call it mine.
Issues Etc. surpassed more than 6.4 million downloads during 2021. You can help us reach more listeners this year. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Old theology, new technology. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry is thousands of people sharing Christ's love and mercy and giving witness to our Lord's creation of life, His design for marriage and the family, and the God-given value of all human life from conception to natural death. Working with many partners, LCMS Life Ministry sponsors human care efforts that meet the needs of body and soul and provides resources and educational events for all ages. To learn more, email lifeministry@lcms.org and visit lcms.org/life.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Christmas, Easter, confirmation, ordination, marriage, new baby, baptism and birthday, Valentine's, housewarmings, celebrations, graduation, any occasion, no occasion, on vacation or consolation. Ad Crucem has all your gift-giving covered. Gifts for yourself, gifts for your spouse, gifts for your godchild or your pastor. Buy from us and avert a disaster. Visit adcrucem.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
We desire for all Christian children, including those with learning or behavior challenges, to receive a strong education in the faith. At simplyclassical.com, you will find reading, penmanship, and copybook exercises based on the truth, wisdom, and comfort of God's Word. We include Aesop's fables and classic children's literature, math and science, all from Memoria Press. Use promo code LPR22 at simplyclassical.com.
LCMS Life Ministry advocates for the unborn, weak, and vulnerable. Check out their free pro-life resources at lcms.org/life, lcms.org/life. We're getting pro-life responses to pro-choice arguments with Dr. Stephen Christie. Dr. Christie, how about the argument that the fetus does not have rights until it's viable or until it reaches a certain level of development, or some would even say until it leaves the womb?
Yeah, so these are the classic, we call them sled arguments, and each of them has their rebuttal. You know, in terms of location, whether you're located in or out of the uterus somehow confers value. And somehow, you know, we talk about how can a 6-inch journey through the birth canal magically confer life or intrinsic value. When we talk about viability, viability is another arbitrary and rapidly changing definition. So what was viable at the time of Roe was around 28 weeks. Viability now is getting closer to around 21 weeks. And there's an interesting argument that somebody once said to me, you know, so viability is the ability of a fetus to live outside the uterus, but not unassisted. It's with the assistance of state-of-the-art medical care. So what's viable, for instance, in Miami, where I'm located, may not be viable in South Sudan. So to pick viability as your argument for the value of intrinsic life, so a woman who's pregnant and she's 28 weeks here in Miami, so that baby is viable because Miami has great technology. And so that baby has intrinsic value. But that mother gets on an airplane and she flies to Bangladesh. Somehow during that flight, that baby loses its intrinsic value because in Bangladesh, they don't have the technology in places to help that baby live. So again, it's another arbitrary decision as to when the intrinsic value in life. And the only criteria we can come up with is an objective one. And that is when life starts. That's when we confer dignity to a human being.
How about the argument that abortion should be permitted until the fetus can feel pain?
That's another common argument that people make. The general consensus has been that fetal pain is felt by the baby around 18 to 20 weeks. There's new studies that now say that maybe as early as 12 weeks. Fetal pain, again, is another arbitrary determinant of when we're going to give intrinsic value to a child. You know, there are conditions, I'm a physician, there are conditions that adults have. It's called congenital insensitivity to pain, where they do not feel pain. And certainly we wouldn't claim these adults have no intrinsic value as human beings. So again, it's just an arbitrary determinant. We have to stick to objective criteria. And the only objective criteria is when you are a living human being. And again, that's a definition that science has clearly settled.
Some argue that the fetus is not self-aware or is unaware, therefore whatever we do to it doesn't really matter.
Well, you're giving me a test here. I got to make sure I can give you all these arguments from this book. So being sentient or aware of harm, awareness of harm is never a criteria for determining whether that harm is acceptable or not. For instance, a drunken woman at a college fraternity party who has passed out is molested by three men. She may never know she was molested by three men because she was unconscious, but in no way does it make that act acceptable. So an immoral act is immoral whether or not the person is aware of it.
I've heard one that a woman shouldn't be forced to live as a human incubator. What is the force of that argument, and how do you respond?
Yeah, for that, I mean, these are from these dystopian movies that people watch, and the argument is makes you think, you know, that conservative or religious people are capturing women, impregnating them, hooking them up to some pod, and making them deliver babies. These are women who have made a decision, right? They've made a decision to have sex with the risk of getting pregnant. We're simply talking about a decision now that these women have. So we have to look at the comparative rights, right? So we're looking at the right of a woman to be free from the burden of a pregnancy, and that's a right of lifestyle, right? That she doesn't want to be burdened for those months. And we have to then look at the rights of the child, and that's a fundamental right to not be killed. So when we compare a lifestyle to life, it's clear that life trumps lifestyle every time. We're not talking about some dystopian fiction movie where we're kidnapping women to bear children. These are women who knowingly have consented to the risk of having a child, and that they may have to bear this inconvenience if the only alternative is killing a living human child.
How about the person who says, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but I don't have the right to impose my views on anyone else?
There's two responses that we have to that. The first has to do with whether, you know, a lot of people first start off and they tell us, well, we should never impose our morality on anybody at all. And that's really a nonsense statement, because we impose morality, all of us, on everyone every single day. We take, you know, on critical moral issues like rape or murder or theft, we never rely on an individual's personal moral code to best guide their actions. We tell the world, hey, rape and murder and theft are repugnant, they're immoral, they're illegal, and if you do them, we're going to throw you in jail. And that's imposing morality, and we do it on every single member of society every single day. So we can't pretend that we don't believe in imposing morality. Every single one of us does, and we do it every single day. The other issue about imposing morality, and we have, you know, political figures who say, well, I'm personally pro-life, but who am I to impose my views on the rest of the world? And again, it's another ridiculous argument. These are critical moral issues that we are obligated as moral people to impose on the rest of the world. You know, we do not allow child slavery anywhere because it's repugnant. We don't say, well, I'm against child slavery. You could have your own slaves. Can you imagine somebody saying, you know, I'm anti-slavery. I would never have a slave. But, you know, if you want a couple of slaves, that's okay with you. Or, you know, I'm personally against wife beating. I would never beat my wife. But you, that's a decision you have to make. I don't want to impose my views about wife beating. Critical moral issues require us and require every single person to impose their morality on the rest of the world.
How about this is a private decision between a woman and her physician, kind of retreating into the privacy of the situation?
Sure. An immoral act is an immoral act, irrespective of who helps you make that decision. And for the same token, if that same physician says to you, you know, I see you're having financial hardship, your two-year-old child has disabilities and maybe isn't conscious of his or her surroundings, go ahead and drown the baby. An immoral act is an immoral act and can't be made moral by the assistance or advice of anyone, a physician, a lawyer, or your friend.
Abortion is health care. That's the mantra nowadays.
Well, we all know what health care is. Health care is treating the diabetic. Health care is setting a broken bone. Health care is performing open heart surgery. Delivering living human beings is never healthcare, and I never let anybody say that it is. You know, and they say that I don't care about reproductive rights. You know, we hear that all day long, as though I don't care about my wife and my daughters and my nieces. We know what healthcare is, and tearing a child limb from limb is not healthcare.
No uterus, no opinion. That's another one you see on signs quite often in pro-choice rallies.
Right. So that I get that. I mean, my wife is very active in the pro-life movement. That's one that, fortunately, she doesn't have to deal with. I get it a lot. And what I do is I echo the words of Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln, and that it would be cowardly and immoral to permit anybody to silence me on critical moral issues based on my skin color or my religion or my sex. That you don't have to be black to oppose slavery. You don't have to be a Jew to oppose Nazism. And you don't have to be a woman to oppose the killing of children. And arguments to the contrary, I tell them, those are bigoted, those are racist, and those are sexist arguments. This is a human issue. It's not a gender issue.
It is argued that if abortion were illegal, back alley abortions would return. How do you rebut that?
Well, there's a couple of things you could say. One, there's a former abortionist who quoted a number. He said, 15,000 women or so per year died from back alley abortions with hangers. A guy named Nathanson. He converted to the pro-life movement and to Catholicism, no less, actually, a couple years later, and admitted he made the number up out of thin air. The number that people probably find out is between 150 and 200 women died per year, which is a horrible tragedy in and of itself. But the vast majority of women who had illegal abortions before Roe did not have them in back alleys with hangers. They had them in back offices with surgical instruments and gynecologist offices. And sadly, that's the abortions that would continue if abortion is made illegal would be the same way. And the other thing we say is, when something is dangerous and immoral, we don't make it legal so that it's more safe. We don't say, kidnapping and rape occur despite laws against them. So let's try to make those things safe for people to do. It's a preposterous argument. We don't want to make it safe to kill babies.
And finally, every child should be a wanted child. It sounds like a great idea, except when it's put in use for arguing for abortion. How do you respond?
Well, I try to agree where I can agree. And every child ideally should be wanted. But when we talk about it being best for unwanted babies or deformed babies or ill babies, I always remind people that it's never an act of love or compassion to kill someone because they're unwanted. How can killing an unborn child, literally dismembering the child while in the womb, ever be for his own benefit? It's the most uncompassionate and unkind and unloving thing you can do for a child. And I remind people, when they talk like this, what they're saying is that it's better to eliminate the sufferer than to eliminate the suffering. So instead of killing a child, why don't we work on improving foster care? Why don't we work on improving the adoption process? How can killing a child ever be an act of kindness?
Dr. Stephen Christie is a physician and an attorney. He's author of the new book, Speaking for the Unborn, 30-Second Pro-Life Rebuttals to Pro-Choice Arguments. You can purchase this new book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Dr. Christie, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, we'll look forward to Sunday morning, according to the one-year lectionary discussing the parable of the sower in Luke chapter 8. Our guest will be Pastor David Peterson of Gottesdienst, the Journal of Lutheran Liturgy. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to 8th grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Criticism.
I just had to call in to respond to this week's installment of Never Trump Drivel from Terry Mattingly.
Compliments.
I love the interviews and insights because they help me battle the slings and arrows of outrageous theology in practice.
Clarification.
Is there a point where, without baptism, infants go to heaven, and after which time they go to hell if they're not baptized?
The Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382.
Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.